My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the November 9th Forum, featuring Julie Sweet, the Chair and CEO of Accenture. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, Denise Morrison, former president and CEO of the Campbell Soup Company, engaged in a fireside chat with Julie Sweet, Chair and CEO of Accenture. The conversation focused on Accenture's role in helping clients execute winning strategies and insight into macro trends such as the metaverse, digital transformation, ESG, and lessons on leadership learned during the tumultuous past few years.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for coming out and joining us for this nice conversation. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like I'm interviewing a woman who I greatly admire, but I'm also interviewing a great friend of mine. So, Julie, I'm so happy that you're here, and thanks for taking the time.
Well, it's great. Thanks for having me. And for those of you who don't know, I met Denise when I became the CEO of North America for Accenture, and I walked into the business roundtable for the first time. I've been the general counsel. I didn't know a single CEO. And I walk into the business roundtable, and there weren't that many women. And Denise and her sister Maggie, both amazing women, immediately came and found me.
Maggie went to Holy Cross,
but. So, and so began an incredible friendship, and Denise and Maggie were both role models and mentors to me as I can on my journey to become global CEO. So it's really, really special to be here with you.
In fact, I don't know if you remember it, but I remember sitting in the Sacramento, California airport.
Yes, I do.
After a networking session that we both attended, and you were talking about your ambition and your dream to be CEO. And I would love for you to share with the group what that journey has looked like and what motivated your dreams and your ambition, your upbringing, your path. Tell us about that.
Sure. So maybe start with leadership for a moment. When I became the global CEO on September 1st, 2019, which was 6 months before the pandemic was declared, so it's been an interesting few years. The first thing that I did actually was to talk about what I viewed as leadership essentials. We were going to do, it turns out in 6 months, the biggest change in our history at Accenture. And I knew that what was going to be most important was defining what leadership meant. And right after always do the right thing and care deeply for your people personally and professionally is my favorite leadership essential, which is lead with excellence, confidence, and humility. When you have humility, you build great teams, your learners, you don't have a, if not invented here, attitude. And I can trace that humility and the value I place on it to ninth grade and my father. So I started high school and I entered speech and debate. And I knew that I was gonna have to make money somehow to go to college. And my father, who painted cars for a living, he was the designated person that would take me to these public service speeches, like the Optimist Club, the Lion Club, and he'd make $500 here, you know, here, and this is like what I did through college, through high school. So I had gotten to the regional round of the Lions Club. And my dad, who, by the way, like he had a little bug, and he would, you know, drive up. He had one sports coat. I mean, we, you know, it was just a completely different world. I really admire, you know, talk about leading with confidence, right? It, you know, he would walk in these rooms. So I gave my speech, and I lost. And I lost to a young woman who was the daughter of a member of the Lions Club, of which my father was not. So my dad's driving me home that night. And I started kind of whining about, like, oh, you know, it was because, you know, she was the daughter. And he looked at me and he said, never gonna change your background. He goes, you have to be good enough that no matter who is, you know, against you or choosing, that they have to pick you. And he's like, and you weren't good enough. And he said it in a loving but clear way. And he was right, by the way. I got much better at speeches later. But it's sort of that you know, that lesson about, you know, you do have to focus on excellence and you do need to, you know, be humble and be willing to look at yourself. And we do that as a company. I do that as an individual. And when I think about the last few years as CEO, where we've changed tremendously, right? It was, in my view, that willingness to challenge, you know, the things we did. In the first 6 months of being the CEO, we changed the P&L that had been in place for 3 decades, right? And, you know, and we said we have to look differently at our business and be willing to say that, you know, things need to change.
And here you are leading over 700,000 people, $50 billion in revenue. So I appreciate the fact that you can be humble about that. So, you know, you've been named Fortune's number 2 most powerful woman. And that is such a recognition. I remember those moments, that list, when it came out and how meaningful that was. Talk about that recognition. What does that mean to you in terms of being a role model for women leaders?
Well, first of all, like one of my close friends was number 1, so I'm pretty happy for Karen. So, you know, my kids were like, "Mom, do you care if you're number 1?" I'm like, "No, it's like one of my best friends." So, you know, so it's great to be on the list. You know, for me, it's really about my team, right? You know, so, my leadership team gets really excited, and it's a reflection of who they are, right? So, always, you'd rather be on the list, not on the list. But really, for me, I love the pride that the entire company comes because it does reflect. And by the way, I say to them, I'm like, until we can get Karen's revenue, I'm not going to be number 1. So it's a good, it's very good to inspire the team, right?
That's great. Okay, you often talk about companies as leaders, laggards, or leapfroggers. And this is their approach to embracing compressed transformation and technology with digital, the cloud, data, and security. And be the real innovators of the future. So how do you think of Accenture's role in helping clients transform and reinvent and continually change their technology?
Well, compressed transformation is probably the single most important thing that companies need to embrace today. So I remember, you know, 6 months into being CEO, and by the way, we have a funny fiscal year, so it's September 1 to August 31st, so we just finished our second quarter. We just put in this big change. We were about to announce amazing results. 11 days later, the pandemic's declared, and no one cared about my Q2 results, right? So I still like to talk about them because maybe someone will like care. And I couldn't have predicted on March 11th that in the first 6 months after the pandemic, we would sign more large, complex transactions than we did in the prior 6 months. Like, completely counterintuitive, except, right, what the pandemic did was act as a catalyst, and it created leaders who said, "We're going to use this time to double down, we're going to go even faster." And then it created a whole category of companies who said, "We've got to leapfrog." And when you look at the almost 3 years now since the pandemic, that is accelerating. And I remember predicting to some of our clients who were still not moving that fast, saying, "Look, in 2 years, you're going to wake up and you're going to see you have to move faster because there's a whole," and this is true across every industry, "cadre of companies are doing it." And just to explain, like, what that looked like in the first 6 months. So you took someone like a Best Buy, you know, number 1 electronics retailer, 1.5 years into the pandemic, Jim Cramer said, "The Death Star of Amazon is over," based on their performance in retail. They were a leader who said, "We're going to move really fast." In fact, 2 weeks before the pandemic was declared, we'd helped them roll out curbside pickup, completely unrelated to the pandemic, was just the next piece of their digital journey. So in 48 hours, they went from 100 stores to all 1,400 stores. You contrast that with a retailer that we'd been talking about curbside pickup since 2016. And they didn't have it, couldn't do it, and they missed the entire first wave. So they came to us in August, and they said, "We can't miss the second wave." Remember when we used to talk about waves? Like, that's all gone now. And they said, "So what do we do?" And we said, "Look, you've got to completely do it differently. Not custom, you know, the good thing of being behind is we have a solution. And they showed us their business case. And I said, okay, guys, like, don't pay us. And they're like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, your business case makes no sense. You, like, this is not worth the investment. And why do they have a terrible business case? Well, because they didn't know there were actually benchmarks, right? They didn't know what they didn't know. And their business case required two different business units to come together who had different incentives, had acted in silos. They were the reason they'd never actually been able to do it, right? So this whole idea of how do you work differently, and they said, okay, we're gonna overcome all of that. And so when you think about what's a leapfrogger, they went from zero stores in August of 2020 to 9,000 stores in November. And so the ambition to how do you actually do things different, but that wasn't a technology play, right? The real issue was never technology, right? It was a culture of build your own, silos, a lack of humility and knowing what you didn't know. And by the way, there was like every alphabet of consultants there, but you gotta listen, you gotta decide, you have to work differently. So. And that's what we're seeing today on much larger scale. So that's a small example. So now think about companies who are willing to make big ambitions. So compressed transformation is changing multiple parts of your organization at the same time. It's doing things much faster. You know, I'm working with one of the biggest consumer goods companies in the world, and you'll appreciate this. Anybody who's ever done an SAP implementation, you never want to do one. They're big and complicated, and this company is one of the biggest companies in the world, and they're doing it simultaneously in every market. Unheard of pre-pandemic, right? But they've got to build their digital core faster. And they got everybody lined up and said, we're gonna do this differently. So it's such an exciting time right now, and that's our role, right, is to help facilitate this type of transformation.
You seem to be ahead of it. I mean, you talk about the five key forces. Tell us how do you inspire your team and inspire your clients to think ahead of what's coming, but still stay in the moment where they can execute?
I mean, at Accenture, and I think a lot of companies struggle with how do you actually have innovation built in your DNA? And for us, it has actually been over decades, right? So our cloud business was $1 billion a decade ago. It's $26 billion today. We started investing in it about 16 years ago, about 4 years before we got it to $1 billion, right? Today, we're investing in space, right? So we'll see where that is in a decade. So, you know, there's an innovation piece, and we've completely changed. When I joined Accenture, the CEO of Accenture, some of you know, Bill Green, he was selling me on coming to Accenture, and he said three things to me. He said, we're all about change, very true. He said, we're fast followers. No one would call Accenture a fast follower today. We have completely changed that part of our culture. Then he said, I'm not looking for a lawyer, which is not rocket science. He was hiring me as general counsel. It was kind of an odd way to do it. He said, I'm looking for a business leader with legal experience. And fun fact, when he gave me my offer, which was in a bar in New York, which could never happen again. And by the way, I didn't drink then, and I still don't drink. He said, my mental model for GC was someone who could become CEO. And I just chalked that off. Anybody who knows Bill is like, he's a great sales guy. So I was like, I'm sure this is just another line. So anyway, it was fun to end up in this role, but he predicted it. So
awesome. Where did the name Accenture come from? What did it mean?
So we paid a lot of money to a lot of companies, and then we ran an employee contest. I wasn't here at the time. And no one liked any of the names that the expensive companies we paid for. And there was a guy named Kim in Norway who came up with a name, and for that, a brand that's, you know, worth a lot of money today, he got an around the world ticket for his family to any place in the world. Like, that is what we paid for the name for Accenture, okay? So I think it was a family of four and they went to Australia. So that's where it came from.
You talk about One Accenture Park as the largest metaverse industry in the world that combines the physical and the virtual. You use it for different things, and you even in your own company, but then also with clients. I think you could probably explain in plain English What is this metaverse that everybody is talking about?
So it's probably the most exciting and least understood in the world. So there's, you know, four things that you can use the metaverse for today. And so the first thing is actually onboarding and training people. So the difference in the metaverse is that it's a place where we can essentially reproduce this room, talk to each other. If I'm near Gene, I can only hear Gene. So it's not one way. So it's an internet of place. It's also an internet of ownership because you can own digital products. You can take them with you to different places. And the four things that are real today is, one is onboarding. So I have 150,000 people. They go to through a two-day orientation, you know, when they join Accenture. And a part of that is in what we call the nth floor. It was built on technology that's not generally available yet. So we were the beta for Microsoft. It's mesh technology, first on Altspace, now mesh. And in that, they get to go to innovation hubs around the world. They get to meet their colleagues, and they have a shared experience. And that was one of the big reasons we did it, was because a Teams call was not creating an experience. We can no longer bring people to our offices. And also, the science says that you learn better in the metaverse for shorter periods of time in immersive learning. So we believe, and we have a ton of interest right now, in the use of it for onboarding and training as a very promising thing you can do at scale. The second big area is the industrial metaverse. And so that is, you know, creating digital twins. So we did that, if you like Skittles, so if you go to CVS, another one of our clients, and you buy some Skittles there, we used the digital twins to reproduce over and over again and create the data so they can actually fill it exactly right. And there's a ton of things that is going on in all industry, both discrete and process. So the industrial metaverse. The third big area is actually, which may be the killer app, meetings and collaboration. So Microsoft and I were asked to build the first metaverse for public good for the World Economic Forum. And Satya and I are on a call with Klaus, the head of the World Economic Forum. It was a couple weeks before the May Davos. It's like, great. And I said, look, guys, this is all interesting. I love it. And my biggest worry is they're going to have all these CEOs and world leaders coming through, and they've like never built an avatar and never put in a headset. You know, they're not going to probably all be gamers. And I'm like, I'm really worried about that. And the team goes, oh, don't worry, Julie. And they switched to a metaverse that they had built of the exact building we were going to be in. And it was three companies. So it's Microsoft, Accenture, and the WEF. None of them had ever been to the building. They had been working collaboratively to create this and to go over how they were going to do it. And I remember Satya stopped the call and he said, this is as interesting as the metaverse itself, because Microsoft and Accenture have been working together for decades and never been able to work in this way. That team landed, and an hour after they landed, they were completely set up bringing, you know, the board of trustees through, because they've worked completely differently. So, you know, at the end of the day, the metaverse will take off if you have the killer app, and that might be it. And then the last area is the metaverse is just going to be another channel, right, for products and services, and it will also create digital products and services. We're working with the Linux Foundation and a bunch of other companies to create the universal wallet so that you can have standards for how you do payments. We're also working with a bunch of companies to establish trust and security, and you're starting to see things like Meta just came out with their latest headset, and it's going to be integrated with Microsoft Teams so that you can have the security of the Microsoft Office 365 suite for enterprises. So it's actually rapidly moving, so much so that we built the WEF metaverse on technology that was better than my own. And the first thing I said was like, why don't their avatars look better than mine? You know, and it's just because the technology is changing so fast. So those are the use cases. And ultimately, we think it can create value that's bigger even than the switch to digital. It's a really interesting area.
Mm. Well, I had an opportunity once to be in a Syrian refugee camp with an 11-year-old girl in virtual reality. And the technology was so real that it was, you know, it certainly pales in comparison to the metaverse work that's going on today. But what dawned on me was the intersection of technology and physical opens up markets. I mean, it's going to be amazing what can be done. And you think about the application in food and in medicine and in agriculture and manufacturing. It's just incredible, you know, that you're all over that as a company. Well, you'll help create it, which is, you know, wonderful, the opportunity to create the future. Speaking of which, you were here in Boston last year at Fortune's Brainstorm AI event. How are you seeing the development of AI, and what does it mean for CEOs and senior leadership teams? How do they embed it in their organizations? And beyond that, what does responsible integration of AI look like for you?
So, you know, AI is the, you know, probably greatest, has the greatest potential and still incredibly underused because of where we all are as companies in terms of maturity. But it's the significance of AI you can see in two things that are happening. So about 18 months ago, I led at the Business Roundtable what we did in 6 months, which is to create a roadmap for policymakers and for companies on how to use responsible AI cross-industry. So first of all, we never like to, at the Business Roundtable, propose legislation, which we were doing. So that tells you something, that we think it's important. And it happened very fast cross-industry in industries that don't always work well together. And right now, I'm co-chairing with the CSIS, which is the Center for Strategic and International Security, with Brad Smith at Microsoft, kind of a who's who globally of CEOs, former policymakers, and officials to influence the next G7 to try to create interoperability and global standards. Because we are so convinced from either productivity, you know, we think AI will have increases of 40% of productivity by 2035, to medical breakthroughs, to lots of other use cases, and we're at the cusp of it now. And if we don't come up with global standards, have responsible AI built in, there's tremendous risks and inefficiencies. So, you know, it's real, but then you've got to go to the reality of companies, right? And we talked a little bit about what are the five key forces of change, and the biggest and most important one we believe right now is taking an approach that every company needs to have total enterprise reinvention, which means that you are systematically gonna reinvent every part of the enterprise. And so you have to build a digital core. And while there are some, for any of the techies, there's some ways of doing things like synthetic data that don't require data, fundamentally, AI doesn't happen unless you have the cloud, you have your data, and then you can add AI to differentiate. And so, right now, many companies are kind of moving from the periphery. They've done a lot around the edges or in parts of their business to recognize you've got to build this digital core and really take on data. That will enable AI. And so I think it's always important to understand, you know, what is required to use AI at scale. And most companies, it's still very early stages.
Yeah. So we're all talking these days about the great resignation, and people just don't want to come back to work, right? They don't want to work in the office. I shouldn't say that. I think people are working. They're just choosing to work differently. But it doesn't disguise the need for highly skilled talent or the opportunities to reskill talent based on some of these future forces that you see coming. Talk to me about how you approach talent today. And how are you, as a major corporation, preparing for the future and the future world of work?
So the second key force of change that we talk about is talent. And it's three things: the ability to access talent, the ability to become a talent creator, so not just a consumer, not just always hiring for the new types of skills. And finally, third, the unlocking the potential of talent. So at Accenture, we think about that as, are employees net better off because they work at Accenture? And accessing talent is, you know, is a multifaceted. It starts with accessing the most diverse pools of talent so that you have broader talent that includes, I see Gerald there, apprentices, which we had 20% of our entry-level hiring in the US last year were apprentices. It includes diversity as more traditionally defined, and it includes being able to access in different parts of the country and the world, as well as through partners. And so that's where remote work still remains an important part, because we have proven that you can do more remote work, which of course Accenture had been doing a lot beforehand. But so that, and then I think the single biggest thing for companies, in my view, in our view, is becoming a talent creator is understanding skills. Because you have to constantly train and you know, upgrade, and you're all seeing that in your businesses today. And most of HR for the last decades has been around roles, not around skills. Well, roles, you don't know what they can do. So when the pandemic hit in the first 6 months, we retrained 100,000 people. And the reason we were able to do that is we had at that time built a database of all of our skills. So we could run algorithms that said, who can be retrained to do security? Guess what? If you did a lot of stuff in risk and compliance, those skills are really good for security. Who can do, you know, cloud? Who can do collaboration technologies? We've now migrated that to Workday. We help them build their skills cloud so that other companies can move HR from roles to skills. And then you can partner or develop. We spend $1 billion a year. Not everybody can spend $1 billion a year on training. And so you'll have to partner in cases. But if you have skills, then you can know your talent. You can know who can be reskilled. What skills do you have? What do you have to go after? And you know, I think a few years from now, HR will have completely shifted. And so if you know, you're not talking to your CHROs or the CHROs in the room around skills, I would definitely be asking about it, because it's now becoming easier to do because you have things like the skills cloud at Workday, but it's fundamental to competitiveness in our view.
One of the hardest things right now, and one of the most important. So time is the CEO's currency, and you get pulled in a lot of directions today, externally and internally. You've got two daughters and a full life. How do you think about the integration of all of that? I notice I didn't say balance. I don't believe in it.
Denise taught me early on, there's no such thing as balance. I call it the power to say no. You know, I have two teenage daughters, and as a woman CEO, you get asked a lot to be on boards. And I now am not asked, because I was actually up front. I remember I told the first recruiter this, and there was like silence because they weren't quite sure how to respond. I said, look, I have two daughters. Point in time, they were in, you know, seventh and eighth grade. I said, I'm not going to take a board until they graduate from high school. I said, because I can't spend a minute extra away from them given my job. And I remember the first one was kind of uncomfortable, like, I don't know how to respond, you know. And but you know, that's what I tell everyone. And I think, you know, it's all about prioritizing about what you do. And I had, when I was, I guess, 44, I had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you quickly think about your life. And, you know, the lesson I took from that period, I was really fortunate that when I came back to work is, I say to myself, like, if tomorrow I was diagnosed again and, you know, was facing sort of this, you know, very serious health issue, would I feel okay with how I was spending my time? And you know, I ask that question to myself, and sometimes the answer is no, and then I adjust. And it's a pretty simple test for me. And I don't always get it right, but it keeps me grounded.
Mm-hmm. How about any questions from the audience for Julie? Oh, come on, you're making me do all the work. Jean, yes.
Thanks for the question. So we're trying to move toward creating more digitized solutions so that all the lessons that we learn, we can kind of get clients there faster. So we actually built something called the Reinvention Console that was built off of how Amazon operates. So you have one thing going in, you know, one way to get into all our access. So we're actively working on that as a big shift in our industry.
Other questions?
Thank you. I think you've spoken in the past about ESG and stakeholder capitalism, and I'm just curious for your reflections on some of the controversy that's been in the news most recently.
Yeah, I stand on the controversy because we focus on ESG because it's good business. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, whether you think about access to talent. You know, I have a lot of CEOs who are like, Julie, help me figure this out, because if I can't be attractive to whole pools of talent, because I'm not inclusive and people don't want to come work for me, I can't hire enough talent. Consumers care a lot about sustainability. So, you know, I've got companies saying, I need to trace from product to manufacturing because my consumers care about where the product came from, right? So we measure ourselves, and if you listen to our earnings, the first part of earnings, every quarter is we talk about what we call 360-degree value, what we're doing for our shareholders in terms of the financial results, what we're doing around the planet, around talent, around diversity, because this is good business. And, you know, I don't have much more to say than that.
Yeah, with ESG, you know, it's the genius of the and, not the tyranny of the or. As long as the initiatives are strategically relevant to the company, it's good business to have those strategies. And so thank you for sharing that. That was a great question. Other questions? How are we doing on time? Yes.
Thank you. Julie.
Thank you, Warren. Warren mentioned that you're on a board that focuses on disability. Can you tell us what prompted you to serve on that board, and what do you get out of that experience?
So when I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, and my parents used to say, we don't have money, but we have time. And so I grew up doing service with my family. So when I went to college, I said I wanted to start as I wanted to continue my life. So my freshman year in college, I looked around for volunteer opportunities, and there was something listed at a local organization for actually teenagers with mental disabilities. And so I went and I volunteered. And I remember just being so sad because they were teenagers and they were soon gonna age out. And at that time, this was, you know, 30 years ago, right? They had no opportunities to get jobs, and they were headed toward homes. And so this really touched me. So when I became a first-year lawyer, my first work that I did was with an organization that helped kids with disabilities. And when I then became CEO of North America, the Marriott Foundation had this group, and I really, you know, wanted to give more focus, because there's been a lot of focus on diversity, but not that much at the time. This is back in 2015, in disabilities. In fact, I remember I went to this conference, this dinner, this gala, and there were no corporates. It was like the American Association for Disabilities. There were a lot of lawyers, and but not a lot of corporates, and that's changed now. It's getting better, but I wanted to bring that my knowledge and my focus on that to the, you know, a broader corporate world, and I thought it was important that, you know, that I select a board that reflected that and showed how important it is. And the Bridges is fantastic. It provides jobs. We hire people at Accenture from the program, and I just think it's a really important area to focus on for companies.
Other questions?
Yeah. One more question. Thanks for your comment about responsible development of policy around artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence has great potential to transform society, but it's also at risk of being overhyped. And how do you guide policy with a technology that's so new that it's on that cusp of science fiction, but also reality, so that policy is well grounded in in reality, ultimately?
Well, I think it starts with knowing what you don't know, right? And so, you know, I think one of the reasons we're working together with CSIS is to bring together policymakers, technologists, companies who are actually using it, to bring that knowledge together and try to create responsible legislation and standards that allow for the fact that technology is going to change over time. And then when you look at what we've done, like at the Business Roundtable, when we created the roadmap, there was a roadmap for the policymakers, but there was for companies. And I remember, you know, one of my colleagues, Jane Fraser, said, you know, I had everybody read this, you know, because that was what it was created. It was created for the C-suite of companies to begin to say, like, this technology is going to change over time. These are the things you need to know and the questions you need to ask. We didn't try to be industry specific, because by every industry, but the same set of questions and standards. And if you don't make those a C-suite imperative, right? If you put it off to, it's just your technology, if you don't begin to educate from the beginning, then the right questions won't be asked in terms of the responsible use of it. And we find that at many companies, the C-suite, you know, they've had plenty of discussions around how cool AI is, or they've, you know, had their, you know, foray to the valley, or they've, you know, had someone come in, but they haven't had that same sort of, and here's how we have to think about it from a responsible perspective, and that education, you know, is missing. And so, and I thought it was really significant that the CEOs of the Business Roundtable recognized that, because it's, you know, it's not without consequence to say, you know, this is something we are putting out for other CEOs and companies to embrace. And I think if we do both of those, we work together collaboratively with policymakers, and then we as companies take on being responsible, educating the C-suite, and recognizing the change of the technology, then we'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Julie, we're proud shareholders of your company, first of all, but I have a two-pronged question. One, you talk to corporate CEOs all the time, and what's the vibe you're hearing from corporate CEOs? It may vary by industry segment, but if you could share a little on that. And then two, the digital transformation that's been going occurring for these last several years, do you feel that you're hearing from those companies that are undertaking that, that when we come into this potential downturn, this is going to make them stronger, potentially coming out of this maybe more difficult economic environment that we might be facing? Thanks.
I will say there's more optimism than I think you'd maybe see from everyone talking about the recession. There's just a lot of conversations on, I know we're supposed to be going to a recession, but things are still going pretty well. And a lot of the CEOs I'm talking to are trying to use this as more of a catalyst to get the organizations, you know, to do more compressed transformation, you know, take on some of those issues. I mean, there's certainly, if you look by industry, you know, it's funny, I'm talking to a bunch of oil and gas CEOs next week, and one of the things I have to say to them is, hey guys, just because you're making a lot of money, you still need to keep your transformation, because like a year ago they were, you know, going gangbusters on the transformation, and then, you know, you sort of kind of get it. So that's sort of like, why do you have to do it anyway? And then, you know, if I'm talking to consumer goods companies or retailers, they're all like, help us cut costs. We need to grow and cut costs. So, but I'd say in general, there's more optimism that it can be managed than, you know, maybe the media would like to, and certainly in the conversations. And there isn't a lot about holdback, it's about going faster. Right. So, and then I'd say that the shift that you're seeing, we talked about leaders, laggards, and leapfroggers before, but this idea of total enterprise reinvention is about creating a new performance measure. Because if you only look at the benchmarks in your industry, then, you know, that's great if you're behind. It's not great if you're there, because technology actually enables you to set new frontiers. And I encourage you to, Roche is a great example of a company that was a leader and then has moved to total enterprise reinvention. They don't call it that, but of course, when we call these trends, it's because we look across industry. And I'll just give you quickly the example. So back in sort of 2015, 2016, they were facing their three big oncology drugs coming off patent. one of their big competitors had made a big move. And so, you know, they were no longer to be number one. And at the time, they chose to digitize the most valuable part of their business, R&D, right? And to create digital products and solutions. And by the way, they did it in the right way. We spend tons of time trying to explain to people how you have platforms and, you know, don't do one-offs. And they said, we are going to create a platform that they can we can use across our drugs. So think of it as across brands. And they did that extremely successful. Their first thing we worked on was Navify, which was for tumor boards. So they help people, they have oncology drugs, and then they help the treatment teams more quickly diagnose the tumor. So they went from 1 in 5 patients having to be put off to 1 in 10. Like, it's amazing outcomes, right? When they have a multiple sclerosis drug, they use the exact same platform, different medium. It's not a one-time diagnosis, it's ongoing, but they built a platform. So they did everything right, build, scale, digital products and solutions. They came to COVID, they were able to use the platform, fantastic. But what they recognized was they hadn't actually digitized the whole enterprise. So they had supply chain issues, they had resilience issues, right? They weren't able to move fast enough to identify, you know, where were they gonna, you know, have supply chain issues, for example, and that. And so in 2020, if you look at their investor deck, it's excellent because they said, we have a new strategy. They moved very, very rapidly and said, we cannot only digitize a part of the company, we actually have to be systematic. Like, their salespeople couldn't go to the hospitals anymore, right? Because all of that was old school showing up, right? And so as you sort of think about what our leaders or people who are behind doing is they're changing their mindset, right? Instead of saying, I need to go convince someone that I need to digitize, right? So like, I got to convince the CFO, I got to convince, it's like, no, no. The strategy is going to be that we will have to digitize the entire enterprise and we're going to have to work differently and do all of those things. Now it's the question of what's the pace? Where do you begin? Where are you at? It's a very significant shift that enables you to go much faster. And so I've got like some companies where I'm still, they're still trying to convince people to digitize, move to shared services and doing that, where I've got other companies who are saying, no, no, it's happening. Now it's just about the order. Right, and I think this is different. Like, it's been building for the last 2.5 years, and we see these leaders doing it. It is going to be a big shift 3 years from now. I will be talking about those companies who took that approach. So it's different than just leaders and laggards, right? It's a new strategy that we think will set truly new performance frontiers.
I think we have time for one more question. One more.
I got the mic, thanks. So thank you very much for your presentation. I'd like to take the discussion in a slightly different direction,
sure,
if you don't mind. So as a woman CEO, you've likely had to deal with a lot of male CEOs. And I'm wondering, I'm just curious, in your opinion, do men and women lead differently? Are there examples you can tell us from your career where that's played out? And anything we male CEOs can learn?
You know, what I would say is that once you're a CEO, there's like no issues. It's like you're just, you know, a CEO. So like at the Business Roundtable, there weren't that many of us, but there was no issues about men and women. I would say that for me, it's less about gender and more about, you know, just sort of fundamental beliefs in what are essential leadership qualities. And, you know, I talk to men and women CEOs all the time, and we're having the same discussions. It's all about talent, it's about culture, it's about leadership. And that's why I think it's so important when you're thinking about change is to focus on what are the leadership qualities that you want as an organization. People will instantiate those differently based on their particular style, but you know, that was why it was so essential. When I started as CEO, I was going to put in the biggest change in our history in 6 months. Designed, announced the fastest. We changed 200 of the top 300 leaders in a single day. 99% of our 500,000 people at the time had something change. We took out an entire part of our matrix. We changed our P&L in the middle of our fiscal year. And we did all of that. And the biggest part of it was the fact that we had defined what leadership meant and that I had established credibility that it was client-led. So my first quarter as CEO, I put out a scorecard to my top leaders and it said how many client meetings I'd gone to, how many ecosystem partner meetings. That was it. Never changed a KPI. So that when I announced that change, every leader knew. They may not agree, they may not like giving up their P&L, but they knew that it was based on a deep understanding of clients, right? And that was the currency at Accenture, right? So whether you're leading an organization and you're trying to change, understanding what the currency is, what the art of the change is, and then what are the leadership qualities that you need. I think we're at time.
And Julie, I just want to say you're an amazing role model for both men and women leaders, to the point where I actually invited my daughter, Michelle Chenery, to come hear you today because I wanted her to be inspired.
Well, I'm really honored. So
thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Julie Sweet, Chair and CEO of Accenture. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.